Okay, next. Da-da-da, they just appeared behind me. I'll hand straight over, but I've got another wonderful two guests, two from here. We have Erin from the Shoreham site and Charlie from New England, who've worked hard to get together. We've got Laura, who is from Holland Road Church, Holland Road Baptist Church in the Brighton Town Centre. And, oh, well done. I know there'll be a few other Holland Roaders that are here. And also we have Rachel Wilson, who is from the New Frontiers Eastbourne Church. So I'm not going to steal your thunder, but we are so grateful that you've come and going to share with us.
Yeah, it's such a privilege to be able to interview these two wonderful ladies. So I've had a bit of time to talk to them, and their stories are just phenomenal. So I'm so excited to hear what you guys are going to say. But before I rabbit on more about who you are, probably is more helpful if you tell us a little bit more about yourself. So Rachel, if you just want to give us a bit of an intro into what life looks like for you.
So I'm from Kings in Eastbourne, and actually I moved to become part of that church when I was 4. So I've kind of seen it. I've had the privilege really of seeing it change and grow, and ended up marrying one of the leaders. So I'm well and truly stuck there now. And I'm at the moment at home full time with my children. I've got Zeke, who's 5, and Anna, who's 3.5. I'm sure I'll talk a bit more about that later on.
So I live in central Brighton with David, my husband, and my 3 children, who are Lila and Amy and Jonah, and they are 8, 6, and 2. And I'm working a few days a week as of fairly recently and recruiting a team at the moment of creative people. But I've been in Brighton for about 10 years. I grew up in London, and I've been at Holland Road since I moved to Brighton about 15 years ago.
That's great. We've been hearing a lot today from a whole range of women, stories of their lives. And it appears that often we really realise God's strength in some of the more difficult times in life. And we know that you've both had various struggles through your journeys. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about those. Rachel, maybe you'd kick us off.
Yeah, so like I said, I've grown up in Eastbourne, ended up marrying Andrew 10 years ago now, which is crazy. And we kind of had really a plan for our lives, quite a clear plan. And ended up, 'cause I went to uni at Sussex, actually, in Falmer. And did an internship after there. So I studied international relations and development, and then did an internship in Washington with IJM, and which was amazing and brilliant. So we kind of had always assumed that we'd be in ministry together or go abroad, be involved in something to do with human rights, and that Andrew would preach or write or whatever. And God spoke to us really clearly to stay in Eastbourne, which I am so grateful for now, looking back, and at the time it didn't make sense. But basically everything went a little bit crazy. When we had, after uni, I'd started a job there, and then we had our first child, Zeke. And Zeke was a really good baby. He was sleep trained at 11 weeks. He was a really good baby. And so we got pregnant with our second when he was 9 months. Had quite a small gap, and it was kind of, actually it was the day that I went into labour with Anna that Zeke had a schedule of growing skills done, which the health visitor usually comes and does, doesn't she? And he was 18 months, and that was the first really alarm bells that went off, that something wasn't right, because he still wasn't hitting his 12-month milestones. And as time went on, he seemed to catch up, things seemed to be going well. And then it was like he hit a wall at 2.5. And he basically is like, he then reversed through his milestones and lost the ability, lost speech, lost play skills, eye contact went. And week by week, his skills diminished and just kind of went, yeah, into reverse, basically. And at the same time, I'm going on here, but at the same time, our little girl started having seizures, and she was 1. And having several quite regular seizures. And we were like, what on earth is going on? Really, that's been our story. Both children have been diagnosed with severe autism. And that has been, like, completely turned my world upside down and my plans upside down, really, and has been quite a challenge to work through and has become all-consuming. I think when you have kids, you never realise how all-consuming it's going to be anyway, do you? But it has been a really quite a steep learning curve over the last years.
And what does life look like for you then on a day-to-day with looking after the two children?
It's easier this year because Zeke started school, but autism affects every part of their life. So he starts the day somewhere between 3:30 and 5 in the morning, and he's up, and he's quite hyperactive. And he doesn't have a long concentration span, and he's just started to play independently with trains and things, but up until now hasn't played. So it's been quite full on in terms of needing constant support. Our little girl has the same form of autism where she'd hit 2.5 and also lost all her skills, basically. And she is just coming out of that. But they both need one-to-one support pretty much the whole time they're at home. So to take them out anywhere, I need to have someone else with me. So I can't take them to the park or out on trips by myself. So that's been quite a challenge. I've had to receive loads of help, and that hasn't come naturally. That's actually been quite a challenge to be the one who's kind of asking favours or just being the recipient of help rather than the giver. But.
And Laura, coming over to you, you also have had to walk through some quite difficult things, not quite the same as Rachel, but yours is more of a story to do with loss, isn't it, and bereavement. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose like Rachel, you kind of have a plan for your life and everything's very straightforward, and I had a very happy childhood and very happy family life, and I got married quite young, and a few months after I got married I went back home to London for family Christmas, and I had three younger teenage sisters, and we had a very happy family Christmas. And that night my dad, who is 49 and he had his dream job, he was head of heritage at the BBC and very happy stage in his life, he had an asthma attack, and we tried to revive him and we couldn't, and by the time the ambulance arrived he'd died. That taught me, and this has come up again and again today, hasn't it, that we really aren't, we have no idea what's around the corner in our lives, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't know what's going on. And it was, you know, you spend the next month in shock. I remember coming back down to Brighton just staring at a jigsaw for about a week, just trying to work out how to function. And David and I were sorting out all the funeral arrangements, telling everyone. There was huge shock, everyone who knew him. I mean, his funeral was an enormous witness to his faith. We found he had coach loads from the BBC come, all these bigwigs and all the receptionists. He was the life and soul of the party. He knew everyone. And we found a piece of paper that he had written, which we knew nothing about. He had he'd written a book recently for HarperCollins Publishers, and it was about to be published, and they'd asked him to fill in a questionnaire. And some of the questions on it, one of the questions was, what has life taught you? And he had written, Jesus is at the center of everything. And it said, how would you like to be remembered? And he said, as a person of faith and joy. And it said, what would you like on your gravestone? And he'd written, I am the resurrection and the life. And then there was one other question, which was, what would your motto for life be? How would you sum up what life has taught you? And he'd written, don't look back, look up. And that I took that, and as the years go on, and this was 14 years ago now, this has sunk so deep into my heart that, you know, we all have a tendency either to look back or to plan for the future. And I've always been quite a present-minded person anyway, but I think at that point when I realised that we have no control, we have no idea what's going to happen, we just have to rely on God's grace and favour for the day, do what's in front of us. And the only way we can do that is by looking up. And at the time, I remember a few weeks later feeling like this. I had this kind of picture of a stone being dropped into the sea and falling silently to the bottom of the ocean and kind of lodging there in the sand. And nobody could see or hear, but that had happened. And I knew that that's what it felt like for me. I had this stone that would always be there. And Not in a kind of comforting way, not a horrible way, but this was a marker in my life. And then move forward 10 years, and the girls were born and were complete delights. And so we just assumed we'd have another one, and I got pregnant, and then I had a miscarriage fairly early on. And I knew people had miscarriages, but nobody had ever told me that with a miscarriage you give birth, you know. And I had a was a painful experience, and no one really knew about it. And we don't talk about these things. And it's so great that there are organisations like Alternatives who are there for people who have been through miscarriage or abortions. And there'll be many of us here who have experienced that or know people who've been through that. And it was an issue for Dave as well, because I think we talk about these things like they're women's issues, but they're men's issues as well. And the men often have fewer people to talk to. So then I got pregnant again, and this time I found it really early on, and it was identical twins. And I told everyone, and I had 7 weeks of being a complete shock, having no idea how I was gonna cope with this. And then David had to do a funeral for a stillborn baby in our church. And after the funeral, it was this couple. I mean, they were amazing in their deep faith through their grief at that time. And Dave came from the funeral to the scan, and we were beyond 12 weeks. You know, we were kind of feeling fairly relaxed about it, and discovered that neither of them had a heartbeat anymore. And the first thing I said was, oh, I'm so stupid for telling everyone. But actually, the help that we received just from having to be exposed in that way and tell people what had happened for us. And what's been so amazing today is when you have that openness and that transparency, then you suddenly realize that so many people have stories, you know, and I can see you nodding, you know, so many people have been through stuff and can relate and can support and can pray and can help. And it was very humbling for me. I like to be somebody who's fairly in control. But that, you know, the church family are so wonderful, aren't they? The way that you suddenly realize that you have this support, and it's people who know what it is to know God's grace in their lives. And that was what I was going to say, because this other lady at church had this stillbirth, and then I'd had this experience. And without me knowing, a group of women in the church did a ring round and said, we just got to pray, you know? So they all got together, they all came to the church, and while I was in hospital still. And they all prayed, and they wrote down some of the pictures that God gave them, some of the words that God gave them. And I wrote all this down in a book, and I dug it out yesterday. It was about 4 years ago this all happened. I dug it out yesterday, and I read the pictures that had been given. And one of them was that same picture of a stone falling into the bottom of the sea. But she'd put in it, the stone falls, but there are ripples on the surface, and they're ripples of grace. And that was so powerful to me, just reading it yesterday, that actually these things happen in our lives, but there are ripples of grace that extend out from that. And that's what God can do. We don't have all the answers, but he can do that. Yeah, I'm sure you'd say the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you kind of, I kind of grew up really with that. I remember the first time I heard Isaiah 61 about binding up the brokenhearted. And I had such a passion to be the person who did that for other people and who have a ministry to the poor and proclaim good news, bind up the brokenhearted. And it was only when what's happened with particularly the second time with Anna was so painful, because it's like the death of so many dreams of what we thought family life would be like. But it was like this revelation, I'm the brokenhearted and Jesus binds me up. And I think so often we hear that passage about going, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim it to the people sitting in darkness. I'm sitting in darkness, but it's okay because Jesus binds me up. I'm brokenhearted. But there's people, and I think particularly when you're involved in church leadership as well, you have this sense that I will be the giver, I will be the strong one. And it's been quite a revelation when you do have moments of real weakness and real brokenheartedness to go, actually, you're in this. And hopefully, from having been brokenhearted, I'm better equipped to do anything that might impact anyone else. But firstly, he binds me up.
before anything else. But yeah.
I think you're kind of touching on this already, but our next question was really about kind of expectations, because so often I think things happen in our lives that are actually really painful, but one of the most painful things is actually that disappointment of, well, I thought my life was going to be this way and now it isn't, or I thought this thing was going to happen and now it isn't. I don't know how God has helped you really just to deal with those disappointments and kind of what those disappointments have been for you. I don't know if you can talk a bit about that.
I think, yes, so often I worship the God of my plans, and I hadn't realised I do that, but sometimes, I don't know about you, I act like I'm Batman and he's Robin, and I'm like, right, God, I would like to be involved in this ministry or something, and you will fall into line and equip me and all this thing. And actually, he's Batman, isn't he? And I'm Robin. I'm anything. He is in control. He's number one. But that's been a real journey of, actually, I'm not going to worship the God of my plans. I'm going to worship the living God who is with me in this right now. And somehow he's going to bring good out of it. And somehow this is the new story that he's writing. And it's going to be a good story. Do you know what I mean? But I'm not the writer. He's the author of all things, isn't he? And but I think that is a transition. And I think, yeah, coping with disappointment in the middle of that and learning to live day by day is so important. And that doesn't come naturally to me at all. In fact, before I had my children, in fact, I think before we were married, I had the names of our children written on a mug. And I was looking at it the other day. I was like, that's insane. Andrew must have been really freaked out as well if we weren't married. But just I thought, gosh, I've always been such a planner. And that's what God's working in me now, I think, is in terms of for the future. And yeah, worshipping him in the middle of his new plan, and hoping that, yeah, for all his goodness in it, really.
Yeah, I think there's a point in that about bereavement as well, is that it's not just losing a person, it's losing all the things that you had which were associated with that person. And not just plans for the future, but also the aspects of your relationship with that person, whether it's family or friends or anyone, which were unique to that relationship, which nobody else can replace. So for me, with my dad, he was the kind of he had enough ambition for me, for the both of us. Do you know what I mean? He used to send me job applications regularly through the post. You might want to apply for this competition, Laura. You know, you might want that job. And when he was gone, I was like, oh gosh, well, forget it. I'm just gonna roll with it and see what happens. And that drive, in a way, just kind of disappeared from my life. It took me a long time to realize that was to do with him, and to do with that. And there's something about you know, just all the things that we go through in life. It's because you just carry on, don't you? You just kind of day by day by day, and it takes a great discipline to kind of step back and work out, why am I not reacting to this in the way I would have expected? Why am I not being the person I thought I was going to be in this situation? And tracing that back. And that's where, you know, you need the Holy Spirit's help and discernment and other people speaking into your life to do that. And you can't do that unless you've told them what the issue is. And I'm terrible at that. You know, I'm not always the best at being really transparent about what's going on in my life. So yeah, but when you do that, then you get the input, which we all need, don't we? So, yeah.
We heard Emma saying earlier, just I think towards the end of her talk, how God can give us hope even in the very darkest of places. And I don't know, just talking about you, Zeke, being up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I can imagine that's sometimes quite a dark place. And I just wonder what gives you hope in those kind of times, and what kind of things reveal God's strength and faithfulness when you're right in the midst of it?
Yeah, I think, I don't know about you, but I think tiredness brings all my sin right to the surface. It's not like I've become... And I think that's a challenge. I think one of the challenges of going through a time of suffering is I kind of imagine that it would make me more godly immediately. And sometimes it feels like the opposite, doesn't it? You're really tired and you're arguing with your husband and it's all this. One of the things that's given me hope and helped me pray as well is I've tried to make a habit and a discipline of daydreaming about eternity, because I think, like you said, and I think that I've been through a period of real grief. After the first diagnosis, I was almost relieved, because in some ways it gave some answers as to what was going on. But the second time, it just felt like a death of dreams. They'll never ride a bike,
they'll never live independently. They'll never get married. Every day I went out, I was like, they can't ride scooters. They can't do this. It was all about what they couldn't do. And it was so painful. And there was like pain around each corner because you just suddenly have more realizations of, oh, they're probably not going to drive, or they're not this, all these realizations. And actually, I don't think we do need to say goodbye to all of those things necessarily. But initially, it's like a bereavement of what you'd hoped for and what you'd planned. I've just completely lost my train of thought now. I was going somewhere with this. Oh, no. Okay, this is tiredness. But I've tried to make a discipline of daydreaming about eternity. And, you know, when your head goes somewhere and it's often about the next holiday or something. And I realised that I don't need to say goodbye to all those things, because at some point we will all sit around a table and we'll play cards, or they will ride bikes. Or we will go travelling together. Or we will, and in my particular daydream of eternity, it's like the end of Gladiator, when he's in that lovely Tuscan villa and he's looking out at a sunset. And in my daydream, there's Zeke and Anna across the table, and their bodies are completely relaxed, and they're following a train of thought, and we're having a long conversation, and we're laughing together. And I'm convinced that eternity holds that. But also that helps me pray and have hope for now, because sometimes I find it hard to know what with them to pray for, because it's so bound up with who they are. It's hard to pray for healing sometimes. But I can pray for that picture of eternity to be fast-forwarded. And I can pray for an increase of his peace in them, an increase of his government in their minds, an increase of his love, his security, all those things. I can pray for gradually that picture I've got of eternity to be fast-forwarded into the now, for his kingdom to come on earth as it is in heaven. Isn't that what that's my hope for them? So when things are dark, and there have been dark times, then that picture has really helped me. As well as just God's grace is amazing, and I think sometimes I've prayed for things and he blesses you in departments that you think, what? Why there? Like, sometimes his grace comes and I think, I don't know, we were massively blessed. In the middle of it all, I was praying for Anna's development. I'm thinking, come on, God, why am I not seeing here? And we were blessed with an amazing house. And I was thinking, I'm not sure I wouldn't necessarily have chosen it there, but I'm going to take that as your gracious gift. And for some reason, you know that right now is going to, and it has been a huge blessing to us. But it's like in the Hunger Games, you know, when the gifts come down just as you need them. And there have been amazing gifts of grace that have given me hope and like a confidence that he's there, he's with me. In fact, there's one, so I will stop talking about it. But there was one incident when it really snowed heavily the other year, and both the children wear supportive footwear, so they both have orthopedic shoes which they wear. And it was heavy snow. I was trapped inside. Nursery was shut, and I couldn't take them out because their shoes aren't waterproof, and they're not steady enough on their feet. And I went down to the shed, and I felt so alone and so trapped in the house. I thought they weren't interested in the snow. They didn't want to play in it. I went into the shed, and there was a box that had never been unpacked from when we moved in. And on top, I opened the box, thinking, "What's in there?" I opened the box, and at the top is a pair of orthopedic snow boots. And the size of them is 25.5, which is exactly Zeke's size. And it was the size that, in fact, they were better fitting than the shoes he had now, because he'd had a growth spur. And you know when you think, it wasn't even about the boots, because I could have coped indoors all day. It was just so clearly God in the shed then saying, I'm here. I am here. I am in this with you. I will provide all you need. And just those boots have been amazing. We just kept them as kind of like, oh. And they were hand-me-downs from a little boy who had the same condition. And I'd just forgotten about them in a box that was never unpacked. I think, thank you for your grace. Thank you.
And Laura, I wonder if, you've spoken a little bit already just in terms of prayers that you received over those times and what was born from that. I wonder if maybe you could speak a little bit more about fruit that has actually come from those bereavements and experiences that you've had.
Yeah, I think one of the things with my dad is that it's kind of easier to say this all the years down the line. I believe not only that he died at the perfect time for him. I believe that he knew he was going to die. I think he had 24 hours notice, just from the way he'd arranged everything. When I remember that day, the things he said and the things he did, and he didn't want to be old. He didn't want to be a granddad, really. You know, I think he was happy to go. But also the way that he prepared all of us as a family. And then just as that was God's plan for my dad, he had a plan in it for the rest of us as well. And I look at my mum, you know, she was a full-time teacher. She's in her mid-40s. She's got teenage kids, you know, four of them. She's up to her ears. And she had to go back to school after the Christmas holidays and carry on teaching and just carry on with her life, you know. And she did that for a year in a state of shock. And then the pension came through, she resigned, and she spent a year saying, God, what on earth am I going to do? My life has revolved around my husband and my kids. What does the rest of my life look like? And all the things which she had never done, which were part of her personality and gifting, because she had devoted her life to serving us as a family, gradually, and that thing coming up again, that God does this gradually in us, he put them back in her life. And she's incredible. You know, she travels the world. She's a consultant for charities, and she goes into often mission situations, and she can relate to the single women because she's a single woman. She can relate to the married women because she was married for 30 years. She can relate to the people with kids. She's able to bring that kind of pastoral and leadership input into their lives. So God had a plan for her life, and I'm so grateful for that. And for my sisters, they were 15, and yet God used it in their faith to teach them about heaven and about eternity. None of us had heaven as part of our theology, really. We'd never thought about it. It was a nice idea. But suddenly to think, you know, there's a destination. You know, life is a dot and heaven is the line after the dot. You know, we live in the light of eternity, and there's a bigger picture. There's stuff going on we just don't understand, and yet we get to be a part of God's work. It gave my walk with God a depth which would never have been there otherwise, not in terms of understanding, but actually in terms of just that childlike trust. Again, that, you know, that verse has come up again and again today, trust in the Lord with all your heart. And the Good News Bible has it, trust in the Lord with all your heart and don't rely on what you think you know. And that was, you know, that's so helpful, isn't it? We just need that. So I think there's been the fruit for that in my life. And yeah, with miscarriage, gosh, how do you? It's hard, isn't it? I mean, it's again, like you say, as far as I'm concerned, I have three children on earth and three children in heaven, and I'll meet them one day. Yeah.
Actually, just following on from what you said, I was just wanting to chuck an extra question in here. Actually, I'm just so aware that through the really difficult times, actually, we kind of need to cling on to God and cling on to His truth. And I was just wondering if there are any verses or any particular aspects of God that you've particularly clung on to when the life has been that bit tougher than maybe is always.
I think actually about him binding up the brokenhearted was really significant for me. And I think actually for me at the moment, something I'm really living with is he's not given me a spirit of fear, but of power, love, and a sound mind. And I found that really, really helpful, actually, particularly in looking after the kids are very repetitive. And one of the challenges of looking after them is Zeke will tend to take a phrase and then say it and say it and say it and say it. And Anna will be grinding her teeth or flapping or humming or walking in circles but doing something very repetitively. And I've found that really helpful phrase, because as I tend to then follow their train of thought and spiral and start thinking about the future, start fearing, and start being going into my own repetitive autistic fears and thoughts, which go round your head over and over. And it's been really helpful, that phrase at the moment. It's something I'm really living with, a spirit of power, love, and a sound mind. And I think actually, particularly in praying for Anna, I keep going back to the story of Jesus when he goes to the little girl, and they've said it's too late, and he says, Talitha, little girl, wake up. And that's my prayer for her, is when I go in, she's sleeping, I say, little girl, wake up. And I believe, and clinging to that, he is the raiser, he is the resurrection life, and also he will restore the years that the locusts have eaten. And that's my prayer as well for them, is that all of the time going backwards, Lord, would you restore it so much more, restore the years that the locusts have eaten, and bring like resurrection life in them now as well.
Yeah, I think one for me, which kind of caught me unawares one day, is I think it's Philippians 3:1, and it just this kind of throwaway comment talks about worship being a safeguard for you. And it says, keep worshipping because it's good for you and it's a safeguard. And I've really enjoyed the singing today. And I just that reminder that worship is a protection. It's a protection for our souls and for our minds. It's good for us. You know, when Davina says she didn't know what to do, so she just sung, you know. And I can really relate to that. You know, I remember after the first miscarriage, I had Mavis Staples' gospel music on really loud for about a day. And just that. When we worship, it forces us, however we're feeling and however we're sounding, it forces us to look up. And it's only when we look up that we can get out of the spiral and the internal conversations. And actually the lies as well, like Davina was saying, you know, the lies that we start believing and then start affecting our behaviour, it's a way of cracking out of that. Yeah.
I know that you both have husbands that are really involved in church leadership and both part of thriving churches. I just wonder... How people have supported you over these times, how you found that helpful, maybe sometimes unhelpful, and maybe if there are people here today that would have friends in similar sorts of situations, the kind of things that can be most supportive to people that are going through real difficulties. Either one of you.
I think it's... something that I've found really, we're part of a really supportive leadership team, and we've also got another eldership couple on the team who've got a child with Down syndrome, and that was a huge blessing to us. They moved at an amazing time for us, and they've been a real blessing in terms of leadership, because they've really got a heavy awareness of everything that we've kind of faced. But I think in terms of people, things, helpful things that people have said and unhelpful things. I think just when people are going through a time of pain, isn't it? Just it's fine to just go, that's really hard, and not to use the words at least, but just to cry with people and to go, God, that's really hard. I really appreciated that. Even more than people rushing in with answers or anything, just people crying with you, going through it with you. I've had an amazing experience of that, really, at church. That's been so good. And I think in terms of advice for people, do you mean advice for people who are going through it, or so much for people who are watching? Yeah, I think that's a really good place to start, is just crying with people and kind of waiting with them to get to the next stage as well, letting them grieving with them, waiting for them to get to the next stage, to walk through the next bit really with God. But yeah, I think, and then people have been incredibly supportive to us. We've had a really good experience of that, to be honest. But I don't know about you.
Yeah, Holland Road were amazing. I don't think we ate for a month. I mean, I don't think we cooked for a month. We did eat quite a lot, actually. And my friend Lisa, this is the other thing I discovered when I read this book the other day. She just, as soon as she heard, she made a massive fish pie and came around and said, I'm like a Jewish mama, I just cook, have pie. And she just kept giving us pies. And I'm all for just incredibly practical support that doesn't ask for any emotional payback, so doesn't require you to confide. And I think partly because I've got, with my sisters and my mum, I have that kind of very close network. You know, I've sometimes found that in order to be vulnerable, I've needed to come away from the church, actually. And I've found the CCK Women's Day quite helpful over the years. I actually came to one of these when I was in that period when I knew that I was pregnant with twins, and I sat over there and I just cried for the entire day and no one knew me, so it was fine. But that there's sometimes you need to get out of your situation as well, and the people who enable that, I've really valued the people who've taken our kids and who've encouraged me to just get space. That's been really precious.
And finally, it would be great to talk a little bit about the future. So my kind of next question is to you, like, what do you see as being kind of the next few years? What do you see as the next step? How do you feel about that? What do you feel God's speaking to you about in it? So a few questions to go on there. I don't know who wants to kick off.
I think for us, like, the future is really quite unknown. Both of our kids are in the special school system, and that's been a massive blessing to us because they're so well equipped and have such a love and an amazing
time and resources, really, to help them. So my little girl starts school in September, and I have no idea, really. It's a real step into the unknown, really, for me. It's quite an odd thing, and I've taken a real back seat in terms of leadership, and it's been like we've called it the survival zone for the last couple of years. And the thing is, I guess for that, you never know when you're about to enter the survival zone again, do you? And one of the things I've tried to learn is that, like in Joseph, about storing up in times of plenty, because I found when Anna's been in hospital or when things have really been chaotic, you're not doing Bible studies and you're not feeding yourself. You're living off what went in before. And a lot of my spirituality at that point is just going, help, or just kind of reading the Psalms, but you're not. And I think I'm really wanting to kind of store up in times of plenty. And I think I'm hoping that that's going to be a time to do that. But I'm really, I think, open to God. I've been completely submerged within the world of special needs, to be honest. And I've got a lot of friends with kids with special needs and a lot of broken-hearted people around me as well. And so I'm just kind of looking and saying, God, where are you going to open doors in that world as well?
Yeah, I think I just echo that thing about there's different seasons in life, and there's something about kids, you get so immersed in the season that you're in, it's quite hard to imagine that there's going to be a next one. And I've just recently started working some more, and I'm really excited about it, because the job I'm doing is trying to gather a network of people in Brighton to help churches across the country who are less resourced than we are in creative communication. So really trying to help churches with their design and their artistic endeavours so they can communicate the gospel more effectively. And I'm really excited about that. But 2 years ago, there's no way in a million years I would have imagined that I was doing this. And God put it all together like he does. And he doesn't let us see around the corner. And thank goodness for that, because we were saying this earlier, weren't we, that it's so good that we have no idea what's around the corner. But sometimes we find ourselves in a new season without quite realising how we got there. And I talk to friends whose children have all suddenly left home, and they just say, well, where have they gone? What do I do now? You know, and just that reassurance that God isn't surprised by those things. He does reveal his plan, but only at a pace we can cope with it. Yeah.
Just wanted to check that before I outed Laura on something that she didn't want to talk about. You were telling me earlier about connected to your dad, that you've just been finishing some work that he had been doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
He wrote a book called Confidence, which is all about confidence in your faith and your future. And then he wrote a book about C.S. Lewis at the BBC. And it's the anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death this year. So, and he's a big thing in America. So the book that he wrote, I finished it off for him so it could get published, because I was like, there's no way he's going to spend the last year of his life writing a book that never gets published. That would just be wrong. So it did get published, and they've just turned it into a radio play, and they wanted to make a documentary about it. So I had to talk about my dad in front of a television camera, which is really weird, because this is the second time I've talked about it, and the other time was in front of that television camera. But yeah, so if you see a book called C.S. Lewis at War, then my dad wrote it.
Ladies, it's been amazing to hear your stories. We've heard all day stories of encouragement, of just God's strength through our lives. I wonder if either of you have got just some last words of encouragement, if anyone's really relating to your stories today, just to build us up again in our faith as we come to the end of these sessions.
I think one of the things I was thinking about is you never suffer alone. Not only do you go through a period of pain with your father and with your, hopefully, your church family around you, but also I just felt like with what Joel was saying about worshipping your way out of prison, that really impacted me. And I just thought that is so true, because I think in that moment you're also not alone, because you are watched by principalities and powers. And sometimes you don't know that, and it can feel like you're going through a pointless period of suffering. And I found that particularly with sleep, actually. Like in some ways, that's been the most frustrating thing, because it's like, this is so pointless. And actually, even when Anna was diagnosed with the same thing as Zeke, I was like, God, was it not enough? Did we not learn enough the first time? Why? What's the point of having two rather than one with the same condition? And And I really, yeah, and I think there is, that is a real roadway to despair when you think it's pointless, actually. And I think there isn't anything as pointless suffering. I think it is purposeful and painful. But I also think there's a time to grit your teeth and worship God in the middle of the prison. And with what Joel was saying, worship your way out of prison. I think you are being watched by principalities and powers, and there is a spiritual element to every type of suffering. And just to have a confidence that this is storing up something for eternity. This is storing up something for here. And I won't be tricked into thinking this is completely futile, completely pointless, and completely without purpose. Because he does have, there is a plan in it. There is a purpose in it. And ultimately, it's like the line of that song, isn't it? The first and the last word will always be his. And I kind of think that with my kids. I think the first word was his and the last word will be his. And ultimately, basically the whole gospel is summed up in two words, which is he wins, isn't it? He wins. The ultimate, he wins. And not to lose sight of that, really, in the midst of it all.
Should we give these ladies a big hand? They've been brilliant, haven't they?